Are you driving right now? Well, if not, just take a second here to do a little exercise with me. Okay. Press your thumb to the bridge of your nose. Now, draw it slowly over the crown of your head to about where you might have a ponytail. That area under your skull is where you are. Well, at least that's what the brain scientists think. That's also where the you who knows your you lives. But how does it all work? Julian Keenan studies the neuroscience of the self, and Strange Chimp spoke with him.
You know, this age-old question, how do you know your you? It's a hard question to ask. Who's the I asking the question?
Right. That's one of the first complicated questions here. In science, we call it the Cartesian theater, the idea that there's someone inside my head looking at someone inside my head who's looking at someone inside my head, and you keep going in that circle. And immediately from that problem, we jump to a new problem, which is once I figure out that I'm me, how do I know that you're you?
Self-awareness is painful. A lot of the time. I mean, you know, some people are obviously more self-conscious than others, but almost all of us have had the experience. You get up, you get dressed in the morning, you look at yourself in the mirror and you think, oh, I wish I were in better shape. Or you have to give a talk in front of a lot of people and you feel like you're just going to die of self-consciousness. Why is our self-awareness painful a lot of the time?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it's the one I love to talk about. I think it's because I'm an evolutionist that I'm so negative. The negative aspects of the self are clear. I don't think, as I'm speaking here today, my cat is ruminating about a slight she's had in the past and she's planning for the future. Certainly not to the extent that I'm able to do it. The resentments that build, we go back in the past and we play out what we should have said. We go into the future and we say, I'm going to say this. And when you don't say that, then you have another chance to go in the back in the past and hate yourself. So clearly having a self can be a curse. And what we look at is how the self helps create a deceptive world and how it winds up leading to a lot of self-deception.
Wait, what do you mean? So we're having a sense of self means sort of inescapably that we're lying to ourselves?
I think so. You know, I went into this pretty naive. I was thinking, you know, and I think most people think this way, that the self is a wonderful thing to have. It leads to art and music and just tremendous things like jazz and abstractionism and great literature. However, on the other side, as psychological studies began to come out, a number of interesting findings were being published. One was the strength of false memories and how many of our memories are, in fact, not real memories. And then another sort of line of research was coming out showing how often people deceive not only to others but to themselves. So we think that one of the key components of the self is molding reality not so that it's real but so that it's palatable.
Wow. So my sense of self is really kind of a story or even a lie that I tell myself in order to kind of ease my progress through life?
Yeah, and it gets worse. I don't know if you want to hear the "and it gets worse" part.
Yeah, go ahead.
But there's a whole line of research that then shows that one of the things the self may be doing is leading you to believe you have free will when you have no free will. For example, a series of elegant experiments from the 80s by someone named Labette began to demonstrate that when we reach for an object, so right now I'm reaching for a cup, the arm moves first, and then the frontal lobe gets involved, or the self gets involved after the decision is made. And what the self does is thinks that it made the decision, but the arm was moving before the self even knew that the arm was moving. So there's this idea that free will is an illusion, and your sense of self helps to create that illusion that you have free will.
Wait, you mean the body moves first, and then the brain catches up? But then why does the body move? Why did you reach for the cup?
Well, what we think is that there are these areas of the brain that get involved that are reptilian old parts of the brain. They've been around for a long time, and, you know, they're very reflexive, and, you know, they're just tied into some very basic motor systems. And they get engaged, and then your arm moves, and about 2 seconds later, then your frontal lobe gets involved and says, oh, yeah, I meant to move it.
What does that say about higher orders of decisions that we make? You know, I'm going to invest in this stock, or I'm going to take the job, or
I'm going to marry this person.
Yeah.
I mean, we're looking at that right now. Right now, you know, we have this study planned. We're having people make a decision of two very benign objects, two different coffee cups, two different garbage cans, two different blades of grass. And what we think is that we can influence which direction they go in by biasing one of their hemispheres. And after they make this decision, they'll come up with a perfectly rational explanation for why they've decided it.
How do you bias somebody's hemispheres?
Well, we have wonderful machine known as a transcranial magnetic stimulator. So creating the bias isn't the magic. We've known about that for a long time. It's once people have that bias in their brain, will they realize that they have it? And we're pretty sure that they won't, that they'll come up with any other explanation like, you know, I like that garbage can because it was grayer, you know, or some sort of irrational explanation. And if this extreme view is true, then we think that a lot of our higher order decisions may come from pretty old parts of the brain, and we only rationalize them later.
So there's this secondary aspect to self-awareness that you study. Can you explain theory of mind?
Sure. The idea is that I have these thoughts, therefore, when I look across the room and I see another human being, I think that they have the same thoughts that I have. So I can think about what you're thinking about. I can think about what you're thinking about my thinking. And you can think about what I'm thinking about what you're thinking about my thinking. Right? And we can go back and forth with this like cognitive gymnastics where we get into each other's minds. And if I can think about my thoughts and my wife's thoughts, it makes for a much richer social interaction than if I'm only thinking about my thoughts, which does happen on occasion. So the idea is that having self-awareness leads to the awareness of others, which then allows for complex social interactions, really leads for a much richer life, particularly a much fuller social life.
And do these two things, my self-awareness and my awareness of you, do these things reinforce each other, have anything to do with each other?
Absolutely. So, you know, the way I see myself in part comes through your eyes. So if I know everybody in the room is thinking that, you know, I just played the worst guitar solo in the world, then I start to think I'm a very bad guitar player. So clearly, how I think about what you're thinking about me will influence ultimately how I think about me.
Are you saying we use other people as mirrors?
Absolutely. But it's also one of the greatest training tools, right? I mean, that's how we work with our kids. You know, I try to build up my daughter's self-confidence by telling her that, you know, she's the best hockey player in the world, and hopefully she'll start to believe it, and then that will improve her performance.
I just keep thinking that what you're saying is that much of our experience of life and of the world and even of ourselves is a lie.
Yeah. And you can either be depressed about it or just go for the ride. A lot of this remains still to be confirmed and replicated, but a lot of the indications are that we are living in a deceptive world at best, perhaps a false world in its most extreme.
Well, I'm trying to figure out what the consequences are of everything you've laid out. We have no free will. We're basically lying ourselves through life. What do you do with those insights? Should you just sit back and enjoy the dream, or should we all be meditating very hard and trying to lose our sense of self?
I'm going to go with the former. I think a lot of self-deception goes a long way, that giving yourself positive affirmations in the mirror, whether you believe them or not, would probably be the route I would suggest taking. You know, surrounding yourself with people who, even though you know they're lying to you, as long as they're saying good things, that's probably a healthy a healthy way to go. The alternative scares me. You know, we used to think people with clinical depression didn't see the world realistically. You know, they saw it in an overly negative light. Well, it turns out they're seeing it quite realistically, and it's you and I who are seeing it in an overly rosy light. You know, we're the ones not in reality. So the suggestion is that reality is a somewhat scary place to be.
So the purpose of therapy is to learn to be better at lying.
Absolutely. You know, that clearly puts into question this idea of deception is morality. Thou shalt not lie. Well, then thou shalt be depressed.
Do you ever wonder who we'd be if we didn't have any self-awareness?
You know, I wonder that about the chimpanzees, because clearly there are signs that they have some self-awareness. You know, maybe the Buddhists are onto something, that when you go on top of a mountain for 20 years, you know, you lose that sense of self. Maybe there's some serenity there. Well,
yeah.
There better be after 20 years. There better be something at the end.
But I think we do all have that feeling that we wish we could escape ourselves.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure Anheuser-Busch is very appreciative of that attitude. You know, I think that's why we have drugs and alcohol, and, you know, it's a way to get out of ourselves, you know, that inner voice or those introspective moments that are kind of painful.
Julian, this has been enlightening. Thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad we're still laughing.
I think that's all we can do, right?
That is all we can do. Thank you so much.
Julian Keenan is the author of The Face in the Mirror, How We Know Who We Are. He talked with Anne Strange Chaps.